I think it might be a good idea to begin this tape with a few brief remarks about New Guinea itself. New Guinea is about almost 307,000 square miles in area, which makes it the second largest island in the world, second to Greenland. We're only concerned really with the eastern half of New Guinea, which is nowadays called Papua, P-A-P-U-A, New Guinea, and when I was there was just called Papua. And this part of New Guinea was under UN trusteeship. Well, it couldn't have been UN at that time. League of Nations trusteeship to the Australians, who sort of governed it. The western half of the island was known in those days as Dutch East Indies, or Dutch New Guinea, and was run by the Dutch. Nowadays, that part has got some other name, and it's a part of the Republic of Indonesia. The western part is rather fat, long distance from north to south, but the eastern part, Papua, is rather long and narrow. And down the middle of it, east to west, like a spine, runs a high mountain range. New Guinea has a lot of high mountains in it. The highest one is 16,500 feet. That's probably not in Papua, but Papua has some mountains over 15,000 feet, too, in fact, and at least one over 14,000 feet. In area, Papua is over 178,000 square miles, which compares with a land area for California of 158, almost 159,000 square miles. So it's noticeably larger than California. The south side of the island, which means the southern part slopes of the mountain, that's the southern part seems to be quite a bit drier than the northern half. The northern half is much more like dense jungle, and much wetter, much more rain, much swampier, bigger rivers. That sort of thing. In general, the climate, of course, is quite tropical. Near the campment we had at 30-mile airstrip, there was a river. It was, who knows, probably two-thirds as wide as the Shenandoah, but much shallower. It was very shallow, almost too shallow to swim in, except in a few places where it would form pools. But it was nice, clear water and clean, and we did go there a lot, probably every day, some people did, and swam in the water, and or we'd just walk way upstream and take an air mattress or something and then sort of float down the river for half a mile or so. It was quite nice. Soon after I arrived at 30 Mile, there was an amusing incident which took place, though it didn't seem so amusing at the beginning. What happened was that I began to lose my hearing, especially in one ear, and people used to tease me a lot about it and say, mimic me, I suppose, and say, "What'd you say? What'd you say? What?" Anyway, finally I woke up one morning and I couldn't hear anything at all out of one ear. So I went down to see the doctor, and he looked in one ear, and then he looked in the other ear, and started to grin, and he got a pair of tweezers and reached in there and pulled out a wad of cotton. Well, it was amazing how loud everything sounded after that. And you may remember that I told you down at Williamtown we had no radios in the airplanes, at least no working radios, and we didn't have any headsets to wear, so to keep the noise out, we stuck cotton in her ears, and apparently that piece of cotton had been in there for weeks and weeks. Anyway, it was a great thing to get rid of it. One day, around the middle of November, for some reason, we were not standing alert down at 17 Mile, but we were summoned to go down there, or something like that, in the middle of the afternoon. So the squadron took off, and I among them, and we flew practically at treetop level all the way down, which was not uncommon. But when we got within a few miles of 17 Mile and were just over really rather dense jungle treetops, my engine quit. Well, of course, first thing I did was the first thing one always does do in those cases. I switched fuel tanks. I'd been flying off the belly tank at the time. The belly tank normally should last you an hour or close to it, 50 minutes certainly. And but nothing happened, and it was so low that I decided to bail out because there was no way you could make a crash landing in the trees where we were. So I opened the canopy and undid my safety belt and stood up and was ready to get out when suddenly the engine started again, and I was able to sit back down and take over, but of course I'd lost my position in formation and went on in. And when I went back to 30 Mile at the end of the day, I complained bitterly about the fact that I'd been allowed to go off with a belly tank that was practically empty. And in fact, I had been told before I took off that it was full. I specifically asked, and they said, yes, it was. Well, there was some youngster there who was supposed to have filled it, and he probably thought that we wouldn't fly anymore that day, and there was no great need for that. And whatever he thought, he didn't do it, and very nearly cost us an airplane and maybe me along with it. He got bawled out pretty severely by somebody, not by me, though. Along about this time, I got appointed Squadron Assistant Engineering Officer. Now, the engineering officer in any squadron is in charge of the mechanical end and maintenance of the airplanes, and he supposedly knows a lot about them. Well, sometimes he does, sometimes he doesn't. We had a man for engineering officer who was a first lieutenant from Louisiana, a man named Ollier, H-O-L-L-I-E-R. He was not a pilot, but he was a very good engineering officer because he knew his business. The engineering officer is in charge of maintenance. The actual work and most of the responsibility for maintenance, however, belongs to generally a man who is generally a master sergeant, and he is known as the line chief. You hear this word line used a lot. Went down to the line, we were down at the line. I mean, it means the flight line is what it stands for, and it means where the airplanes are in simple terms. So the line chief is the head enlisted man in charge of maintenance, and he's really the kingpin normally. Though that depends a lot upon how good he is and how good the engineering officer is. There's an assistant line chief who's usually a tech sergeant. And each airplane has a crew chief who is assigned to that airplane. That's his airplane, and he's responsible for it. And he generally has an assistant crew chief also. And they're assigned those two men to every airplane. Has a crew chief and an assistant crew chief as a rule. He's the one that does all the work. If you have to change the engine or something, he does it. Those two guys do it. They make sure it's been fueled and that any repairs that are necessary are made and the airplane is kept in flyable shape. Anyway, this appointment of me as assistant engineering officer have no significance particularly, other than the fact that all the pilots are supposed to have extra duties. The saying always was that you are an officer first and a pilot second. And that means that you are supposed to assume part of the responsibility for running the squadron. In peacetime days, when they probably had 25 pilots and 25 airplanes, that was all right. But in wartime, when we had maybe 50 pilots and or 40 or 30, whatever, way more pilots than we did airplanes, there just weren't enough jobs to go around. Anyway, I was given this job, and I spent a great deal of time that month, the month of November and December, messing around down on the line with Ole, as we called him. We also had there for several weeks, I remember, a civilian from the Allison division of General Motors. Allison made the engines in the P-40s, and he had been sent over there to instruct ground personnel in the maintenance techniques and procedures and whatnot. And he was very helpful, especially since a lot of the maintenance crews at that stage of things didn't know much about Allison engines or anything else. So it was very helpful to have him around. I began flying missions around the middle of November. I think that the first actual mission that I flew was on November 17th. And halfway through the mission, something went wrong with the airplane, and I had to go home. The military situation at this point was that the Australians and the Americans, the infantry I'm talking about, had succeeded in preventing the Japanese from attacking Port Moresby. And had pushed them back over the mountains through terrible jungle, and at great cost to both sides, both the Japanese and us. And it pushed them back down towards the north coast, and there was some fighting going along that trail, but the main battle at this time was taking place at a little village on the north side of the island, straight across from us, called Buna. So our earliest missions consisted often of being sent over to the north side, over to Buna, and to do nothing but patrol over the ground troops who were fighting down there and keep the Japanese away from them. It was very effective, I guess, in that while we were there, the Japanese aircraft left the infantry alone. But inevitably, we would have to go home eventually and before dark, And the minute we were gone, down would come the Japanese and strafe the troops. But there was nothing we could do about that because we didn't have any bases on that side of the mountain. Often, when the weather would build up, we would have to go home as early as 2 o'clock or something, and even then we might have to go up to 17 or 18,000 feet to get across the mountains just because of the clouds. These patrol missions, as you probably could imagine, were ordinarily exceedingly tedious because you just fly back and forth and up and down, round and round, once you become very familiar with the territory and the ground under you, there's nothing new to be seen. And you have to be alert and keep your eyes open. And it's very hard to do when things get as tiresome as they often get. Well, when we would start running low on gas, then some other squadron would come over and relieve us, and we would go home, and they kept up a running sort of patrol over the troops as much as we could. At this time, the group commander of the 49th Fighter Group was a lieutenant colonel by the name of Hutchinson. He, incidentally, eventually became a brigadier general. Of course, he's long retired, but he's still alive, and he still attends all the 49th Fighter Group reunions every year. Anyway, I remember the first time I met Colonel Hutchinson was when he flew up one afternoon to 30 Mile to talk to us and to spend the night. And he hung around and had supper, and then we all sat around, and I remember Colonel Hutchinson sat in a chair and he leaned back against the wall on the back legs of the chair, and he got out a little notebook and he looked around and he said, "Now I want to hear your complaints." And I was quite impressed because he listened to these complaints one by one, and if he could do something about it, he said so. And if he couldn't, he said so. And he pulled no punches. He was totally frank and said what he could. Some things he didn't know whether he could do anything about or not, but he'd write them down in his little book. And he was the kind of man who always did what he said he would do, or tried to do what he said he would try to do. He was that kind of man. Occasionally there would be the Japanese would come down at night and bomb Port Moresby. Of course, we were 30 miles away, and we couldn't see much or hear much, but we could tell when this was happening because, of course, all the anti-aircraft fire from the ground at Port Moresby during a raid was visible for a much longer distance than 30 miles. It really lit up the sky. And perhaps we could even hear some of it. I don't know. It was always quite exciting. They never bothered us, however. Up at 30 mile, may not even have known we were there. I see a notation here dated November 29th. Notation in my diary, which will give you an idea of the state we were in at that time. It says, "We now have 11 airplanes, and 11 are in commission." So, you see, we were a long way from the 25 we were supposed to have. But so was everybody else. When an airplane engine is replaced with either a rebuilt engine or a brand new one, they have to be broken in. In other words, engine has to be run for about 4 hours. And this is always called slow timing. Have to slow time the thing. And it's a tedious business because you just have to take the airplane up and fly around in circles or something. low speed and low power settings for 4 hours. I used to like to do this, however, because at least it was a way to fly, and most people didn't want to do it. But I remember one occasion when I took this airplane up to slow time it, and I went around bending time, buzzing the field and things, which couldn't do any possible harm, because if you had the engine set on low RPMs, then it was automatic that the propeller kept the RPMs low and the manifold pressure kept low, regardless of the fact that you might be diving and climbing and things. But anyway, apparently some of the enlisted men who didn't understand this complained bitterly that I was abusing the airplane. Although the line chief and the engineering officer were well aware that this was nonsense, they felt it necessary to humor the ground crews, and so the rule went out that hereafter no second lieutenants were to be allowed to slow time airplanes. I was rather pissed off about this because it was silly, but that's what happened just the same. By this time, we were flying some escort missions for bombers here and there, but and nothing ever happened. At least, not for the time being. One day, some of the local natives invited us over to their village that night to a dance. Now, mind you, we weren't supposed to dance. They were going to dance, but we were invited to come and watch. And so a few of us piled into a vehicle of some sort. And I remember old Ole was driving this thing, and we didn't quite know where the village was, for that matter, and there weren't any roads particularly, but there were tracks through the grass and all, and we went over there after supper. It was still daylight, and drove along, came on one native who was walking along, and we stopped, gave him a ride, and he sat on the fender. Of course, he didn't know any English or anything, and he was, like all of them, a stringy, ugly thing with sores on him and his teeth, absolutely unspeakable what teeth he had. And I remember Ole kept saying to him, "You are the ugliest goddamn son of a bitch I've ever seen in my entire life." Well, this old native didn't know what Ole was saying to him, but he would go into hysterical laughter at these remarks, and the more abusive Ole got, the louder we would laugh, and the louder this native would laugh. It was all rather hilarious, actually. Well, we got to the village and stood around for an hour or so while they had this dance, but it was extremely tedious. All they did, seemed to me, was to line up in two lines down the middle street in the middle of the village and sort of shuffle this way and shuffle that way and beat drums and all. It wasn't nearly as good as the native dances I've seen in movies. And after a while, we got bored with this and went home. One day, Sid Woods asked me to spend the night down at group headquarters. As I told you, the practice was for the 9th Squadron to get up early and fly down to 17 Mile and sit alert there all day and then go home in the evening. But at this time of the year, there was often a problem in that the 17-mile strip, which, as I told you, was built in the middle of a swamp, was covered early in the morning with fog, and you'd get down there and you couldn't land because you couldn't see the ground. And it was a nuisance to have to go all the way back to 30 mile and then wait and hope that the fog had cleared. So Sid said, "Why don't you stay down there? And then as soon as the fog is cleared, take off and fly up here and tell us, and then we'll go down. We won't have to waste a trip." And I said I would do that. But in the morning, the fog was there, and I could see the treetops, and that's all. And I didn't dare take off because I didn't know what I'd be getting into. Well, we had a young fella in the squadron whose name was Jim Watkins, but everybody called him Duck Butt. And Duck Butt had a trademark, sort of, in that he would always slip his landings, which meant he sort of came in a little bit sidewise, and it was very distinctive. You could always tell which airplane a Duck Butt was in because it always came in for a landing sideways. And imagine my surprise when I was sitting around there and the fog was all over everything, and suddenly appear through the fog, this P-40 comes slipping in and landed, followed by all the rest of the squadron. Well, it turned out they'd come down anyway and without me, and had been able to make out exactly where the strip was, and they just landed through the fog. I don't know that that was too smart, but that's what they did, and they didn't run into any trouble. So when it cleared up a little, I went on, got in my airplane, and flew on back up to 30 mile, and the Sid was rather displeased, or prepared to be, and he said, "I thought you were going to come up here early and tell us what the weather was." And I said, explained that I couldn't take off because of the fog, but that the others had managed to land anyhow in spite of that. So that was all right. He forgave me. But I might mention about Duck Butt Watkins in that in 79, I think, when the 49th Fighter Group had reunion in El Paso, Texas, and Duck Butt was there. And he had huge amounts of beautiful white hair and looked very distinguished. And I remember somebody's wife saying to me, "Don't Duck Butt look distinguished with that white hair? He looks just like a senator." Well, he did look like a senator, as a matter of fact. And I was surprised he remembered me, but he did. I remember his telling me on that occasion that he said, "You know, flying a P-38 is just like driving two Cadillacs." Well, I know why he thought so, and it was an apt remark, actually, because the exhaust on P-38s was somewhat muffled, and especially on the ground, and probably in the air for all I know, they had a soft purr to them, and I knew what he meant. Early in December, I got sick with something called dengue, D-E-N-G-U-E, fever, and was sent to the hospital for a while. At some point during this period of time, I got somehow a native servant boy. He was just a teenage kid. His name was Hendrick. And he made my bed and washed my clothes and pulled weeds around the tent and carried water and things, made himself useful, but mostly he was a nuisance. And after a while, he disappeared, and I was not really sorry. One day, I remember that after we had been sitting alert down at 17 mile and were on our way flying back home again to 30 mile, I was flying on the wing of one of the older pilots, a man named Taylor. And I was flying on his right wing. Now, there are various signals you give in the air, which mean certain simple things, and they avoid your having to use the radio. And one of them, if you keep dipping one wing abruptly on one side, that means get over on the on that side. You would only do it if the person you wanted to move over was on the side you didn't want him to be on. That was one signal. Everybody knew those signals. The another one was if you waggled your wings back and forth, up and down, actually, suddenly that meant something like, be on the alert, I'm going to do something. You don't know what, but you better watch, because he's telling you he's going to do something, so be ready. Well, I was flying on Taylor's right wing, and I thought that he dipped his left wing, and I thought he was telling me to move over to the other side of him. So I had ducked down and under his airplane and was just underneath him when suddenly he went into a dive sideways, so to speak.